We are back in the After Dark, continuing our conversation with Ewan Morrison. Ewan, once again, thank you so much. I know this is time out of your day. I know you're excited to talk about Tarkovsky, but thanks for taking the time to talk with us. I'm really happy to talk to somebody else who is as excited about Tarkovsky as I am. Thank you, Patreons. If you're listening to this, we owe you a debt of gratitude, so thank you.
I gotta do the thing. Yeah. Thank you, we really appreciate it. Please continue to support the podcast, tell your friends, share episodes, help us get to that next level. We love doing this. We want to do it for a long time to come. We're going to keep plotting different benefits and bonuses too for Patreon. I mean, now that we're kicking off these live shows, you know, there might be some other fun things we can do. I definitely think we're going to bring our movie watch parties over to Patreon only. So that'll be another Patreon perk. Truly, it's spectacular. I mean, Brad and I had this moment where we did a live show for like 30 people out here in St. Paul, and people liked it, and people want to come and see it. I mean, and we conceived of this podcast in a momentary fit during the pandemic, and here we are. So we genuinely appreciate the support. Cool.
100%. Okay. So talking more Tarkovsky. Now, I know when right after we kind of closed out the main episode, you were like, oh man, there was a bunch of other stuff I wanted to talk about. So I want to open it up to you. I think I heard you mention the director in your, oh my gosh, how do you say his name?
I just go with the second name. I think he's called Inarritu.
Yeah, right. I know who I've seen all of his films, but I never, a word I always stumble over.
I was just picking up something you said about how in Tarkovsky films, there's always the elements, and the elements are so important because they're always reminding you of temporality, of cold and warm and wind and hunger and all these things. And I was thinking, yep, I remember when I was watching The Revenant by Inarritu. I mean, it's entirely about, you know, a man surviving against all odds within, you know, a very hostile, you know, climate, world, snow, rain, arrows, fire, attacked by bear. It's so incredibly physical. And I noticed, like, there are actually some Tarkovsky choreographed shots. He's obviously been inspired by Tarkovsky. And just those long developing shots that last a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. I mean, Inarritu's done an extraordinary job with those. And you just get this incredible sense of mortality and time in The Revenant, right? Mm-hmm. You know, your scenes of just healing from horrific wounds, scenes of watching fire, and these sudden explosions of energy that happen with violence. And then
when the tribe attacks them, that scene, I've seen that movie two or maybe three times. I've seen that scene a dozen times. I would just go back to it. I'm like, all right, how did he manage to pull this off? There's so many moving parts, and it's so engaging, and the camera movement, it's so dynamic, and it's incredible. Yeah,
you know, absolutely. I think that's one thing that Tarkovsky has bequeathed to young directors, is the challenge of doing a 9-minute take. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there might be a certain kind of bravado in that, but it's also a damn art to the whole thing. I mean, it has to, when it works, it's absolutely phenomenal, because you're so in there, in that place, you know. Yeah. It's a much more, I think as soon as you start cutting, something happens. You're placed in a more distant relationship to the images. If you're in a long take, a long developing take, with much camera movement and much, actor movement or nature movement, then it's really immersive, you know? So I think, Inarritu and many other directors have tried to do these extraordinary developing long takes, like Bellatar as well. He's another one. I think there's an 8-minute shot of cows in a farm moving from right to left, and past various buildings, I can't remember which movie it's in, but it's absolutely captivating to watch. And it's just like, oh, there we go. It's another Tarkovsky fan.
Right. Well, and it goes to, I think, what Tarkovsky means when he talks about realism, because there's, you know, he's all about, it's interesting. We hear the term realism, and I think to most Western ears, you mean, well, that means you're depicting something the way it really would be, like it's going to be a realistic sequence of events. And Tarkovsky doesn't mean that at all. It's not about whether this obeys the scientific rule physics or something.
Oh,
it's
indeed very, not.
Yeah, it's very much about, and I think what his point would be is that every time, if you could just shoot an entire film with no cuts, that would be, and it could take place anywhere. It could take place on Jupiter. But if you were able to shoot it all with no cuts, that would be more realistic than a kitchen sink drama that was shot like an MTV music video.
Well, and of course, it's been done, and very famously, Russian Ark, if you're not familiar with that film, they did that. And then Birdman did it. Not that whatever Birdman.
Yeah. I mean, he accomplished it with CGI and stuff, but I suppose the effect is the same, you know? So,
Birdman was in Iritu as well. So there's like another connection there. I think when Tarkovsky talks about time, he's kind of cheating a little bit, because he's talking about the philosophical notion of time, because he believes that the present doesn't really exist. He's very much against this sort of hippie idea that you just got to live in the now, man. Because you know, he believes that the present is saturated with the past. You know, so there's a great quote. I think it was from Sculpting in Time again. He says the past is far more real than the present. The present slips and vanishes like sand through our fingers, acquiring weight only through recollection. So he's really saying that like the present moment itself only makes sense when we allow ourselves to be flooded by the resonances that it has with the past. And I think that's why in Tarkovsky movies you do get these long, beautiful shots, but they're then a patchwork of memory and dream, and then back to the real again. And they're always gaining weight. You know, like in Solaris, it's painful weight that's gained, because it's the loss of a wife. When you go back in time in a Mirror, you're gaining just a whole sense of a childhood of the narrator it's adding the weight of dream and the kind of menacing weight of dream within the present. Yeah.
Right.
So what he's talking about the real, but he's cheating in a sense, or he's being philosophical about it. Because time for him is generally in the melancholic mystic way is more focused on the past really than it is.
For sure. And this comes through in basically everything he's doing, right? I mean, he talks in Sculpting in Time about films being a mosaic of time, and he talks about individual shots having what he calls time pressure, which is this kind of interesting concept that I've struggled to articulate it to myself clearly what he means by that, but it has something to do with saying it the cheapest way possible, with the way time moves within a single shot. And time does move differently in Tarkovsky films than any one of a random number of films. Other people, I'm sure, have accomplished the same effect. But and this is, I think, also where he gets sometimes this dreamlike quality. I mean, he has these shots that are clearly, you know, that's a dream, but the whole films feel dreamlike. And I think it has something to do with that time pressure. I read a thing, an interview with one of the Strugatsky brothers. The Roadside Picnic.
He did the Roadside Picnic, yeah.
Yeah, and they had written a scene in one of the screenplays where a tank, they called it their time loop scene, where a tank keeps going over this bridge. Yeah. And Tarkovsky loved it. He wanted it to happen, or it was just going to be this repetitive thing that happened. And they eventually convinced him to not put it in the film. And I just think that, like, that's indicative to me of a sort of a dreamlike thing that would happen, right? Just the senseless repetition. There's no beginning or end to it, and it's kind of happening all the time. And you see smaller scale versions of that throughout Tarkovsky films, for sure.
And the dreamlike sections and the past section, they often sort of double up in terms of the signs that you see. I won't call them symbols, but you know, so you'll get a repetition of a forest. So in Mirror, again, you've got the wind blowing through the trees becomes an extraordinary presence in itself early on. It's hard to work out why it's so moving just to look at this footage of this wind moving through trees. And then at the end, you've got this amazing pullback shot. It's just of the mother, who's now a grandmother, with the two children from a different era. She's walking with them hand in hand through a field, and we pull back very, very slowly through a forest, and we gradually lose them, and we're heading into the dark depths of the forest. And it's so strangely moving, because on the one hand, it's a real shot, the last 3 minutes in real time, but it's like we're traveling through hundreds of years, you know, or even thousands back to the forest, you know, back to the primal forest. It's extraordinary. So I think he uses the reel in a way that he manages to summon other times into the time that he's showing.
Well, and I think that that's beautifully put. And I think actually this is part of what's going on with the elemental stuff. And I know I'm kind of hitting that point, but like the thing is, it's like humans have been touching and dealing and suffering from and benefiting from these elements since before we ever could talk about them, right? Fire and wind
fire and water.
And they all they all have relationships to each other. And, you know, there's a paper, rock, scissors kind of thing between them, right? Like, you know, and one kind of dominates and or amplifies another. And so in, by dealing with those, instead of dealing in language, you're like dealing with something like the oldest language there is, you know? And I think he's conscious. I think he's very conscious of that.
I think, you know, the ending of Andrei Rublev. So it's such an abstract film because Rublev is a passive protagonist. You know, he's he's the monk painter who renounces his painting because of the atrocities of mankind. And he renounces speech. And it's only when he witnesses the creation of this bell from the elemental forces of mud and flame that he finally finds his voice again. And so there's a real manifestation there of, you know, it's like a creation myth of the read, you know, from the flame and the mud, this artist, this bell is given a voice, you know, the bell rings and it works, you know, it's
and it requires, and it requires faith too, right?
It requires because faith. Exactly.
The man who made the bell didn't know how to make the bell. Right.
That's right. The young man lied about whether or not he could make it. And there were hundreds and hundreds of people were dependent on this bell being made. And so the miracle of actually working was enough to shake Rublev back to his faith again.
Yeah, it's
so
beautiful.
It is. So from fire, the bell found a voice. From the bell, the artist found the voice.
Cinema is alchemy.
Totally.
It's right there it is. There's an interesting documentary by a filmmaker whose name escapes me off the cuff. I'll look it up right now, but it's called American Mystic. Have you ever seen this film? Do you know this one?
Yeah, you've told me about this before.
Alex Marr. And it's a little tidy, little semi-obscure documentary, but it is about three different American mystics. One is a pagan priest or a witch named Morpheus in rural California. The other is a guy, is a black fellow named Kubla, who is a spiritualist who works on a farm in upstate New York.
And then
the third is a young man named Chuck, who's a Lakota Sioux, who's getting ready to do the Sundance. I mention this because if you're interested in mysticism in film, I think that you may enjoy this. But the sneaky thing she does, and it's a little, maybe a little on, it's not Tarkovsky. I don't think she would should claim to be working at that level, but she does make this sneaky case that like there's a fourth mystic in this film, and it's the filmmaker. And I love that kind of thing. I need to watch this Andrei Rublev. I need to watch this.
True Blood. Yeah, no, it's got these extraordinary set pieces. It fails in the contemporary test of having an active protagonist who's seeking to fulfill their goals, because it's really about a person who's running away from their own talent. And for the majority of so, but there are these extraordinary things when he loses his faith. I guess he never articulates it. I mean, he's a Russian Orthodox monk who goes on to become one of the greatest painters in the history of Russia. But he really loses all sense of direction. He finds himself in the middle of a pagan festival, chasing virgins who are getting chased by people with lanterns in the middle of a forest. He gets stuck in the middle of horrific violence by the Tatars. They burn down churches, and he's like an existential anti-hero who's just lost in the world until he finds his art again. So yeah, I think it's part of that great, you know, existential anti-hero narrative tradition, like Camus' Outsider as well. And it's very rare in a movie to find a kind of absent protagonist like that, you know.
Yeah, so. and have it work and have it be so compelling from scene to scene. Yeah, that for sure. I do. We're not going to spend a whole lot more time here, but I do, because I teed it up. I do want to pose this question just as an open discussion. What do we do? And maybe Ewan, you'll just say, I don't care. And that's a cool, that's a perfectly fine answer.
There's a lot of things I don't care about.
Yeah, sure. Me too. but what do we do about this? This is the separating the art from the artist thing. Tarkovsky being such a son of a bitch, sleeping with all the leads, you know, being physically abusive.
Hey, listen, it's in the contract, Brad.
Right. But Natalia Bondarchuk, like, almost killing herself because of it. All of these things, just the sort of this, you know, the kind of things that somebody who's a bit monomaniacal is the kind of wreckage they're going to leave in their wake. Obviously, we can still watch these movies, but does that color the way you deal with this work in any way?
No, not in the slightest. You know, Bergman was even worse. Ingmar Bergman, right. My God, the life of Ingmar Bergman was like the romance problems of ABBA, you know, or Fleetwood Mac. You know, it's
I
like
did not know that
everyone was just like shagging everyone else, and he was, you know, with one of them and then with another of them.
But Bergman was in the theater.
He was in the theater.
Right? Right? Yeah.
Oh, so that excuses it, right?
Well, no. It helps me to understand it. It helps me. It gives me a way. And one of my favorite all-time tweets is, I don't know who tweeted it. I need to find it. But the tweet is simply, you have to be so horny to make theater.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, I guess that's true. Well, you know, I think that there's one thing that we have to be aware that we don't have double standards on this as well, you know.
Yeah.
So do we want our artists, our artists and musicians and filmmakers to be better people than we are? Or is it okay if they're just as flawed as we are and they create beautiful things out of it? And when, you know, and it's not like we've got role models anymore. I mean, we've had like a bunch of presidents that have done some pretty bad things in their personal lives, you know?
Well, and then this begs the question, if we don't have role models, do we have roles anymore? That's almost.
That's a good question, right?
Right?
Well, yeah, but I think one of the best roles ever was the anti-role model was Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment. Mm-hmm. So he's someone who's an intellectual nihilist who thinks, do you know what? God is dead, therefore I can kill. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so he's the worst possible role model. I guess by the time you get to the end of the story, he repents.
Yeah.
I'm very wary of the idea that we set higher moral standards for ourselves than we for representations, full stop. Mm-hmm. In movies, in music, and whatever, that we're trying to depict perfect people, or trying to hit some quotas on what we think that might be. So it's got a kind of deadening effect, you know, on culture. Who wants to watch protagonists who aren't screwed up? And you know, maybe the best people to talk about screwed up protagonists is screwed up directors.
People that are always screwed. No, I 100% agree with that. And it's just, it's funny. We do see in this sort of the algorithm of how we interact now in social media seems to be like a heat seeking missile for flaws, right? It's going to find whatever. And so every 6 months, you're going to have the William S. Burroughs shot his wife in the face discourse. Right. And it happened, and it's part of the story, and it's not okay that he did it, but it's,
I think that there's a completely unarticulated and sort of shameful, awful thing that needs to be said about this, which is that in a mass culture where the masses finally get a voice, there's a hobby that the masses like doing, which is taking out the famous people, you know. It's a full-time sport for for some people. You know, it's not just trolling. You like pile on a famous person. What did you do this weekend? Oh, I took down a pop star.
Right. You know, and the thing is too, the way that works is you set up standards for these people, like a pop star or whoever, to try and live to. And the goalposts keep moving. So all they do to try and live up to them is become less and less like themselves. And they're going to step over the line for something else anyway. You know what I mean? It'll be, you see blowback for stuff that five years ago was.
You just go so far forward that you end up back in Scarlet Letter situation.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe the underlying problem here is this notion. It's a very American notion of perfectionism, you know? So, the idea of a perfectly moral person came over on the Mayflower with all these nutcases that we threw out of our country.
You're talking to a couple of Catholic boys. So we get it.
Okay. So, that's great. So, I mean, to go back to Tarkovsky and also within Catholicism as well, just the idea that human beings are flawed is a great way to approach everything. I find, you know, and you know, what was that great Tarkovsky quote? He said, art could not be made if the world was perfect. Art comes from an imperfect world.
Yeah, that's true. I think we can end it there.
Let's end it right there. Yeah. Ewan, this is a true pleasure. These episodes will come out very quickly, so get ready. I'll drop them soon. Brad, thank you for organizing this. Any final words, Ewan, or do you maybe leave it?
No,
at that?
I'm good. Yeah. I'm really pleased to have done this, and it's been so great talking to you guys.
Well, I'd love to do another darkroom with you anytime. It sounds like maybe Bergman would be a good one down the line.
Oh, sure. Bergman. He's a creepy guy. Yeah. No,
sure. All right.
We've done a couple full-on creeps, so he wouldn't be the first. Yeah. We'll talk. It would be great to have you come back on sometime. We'll find a good way to make that happen. But thank you so much for your time. It was a real delight to meet you and get to know you. So
fantastic, guys. Lovely to speak to you. We can talk about books. We can talk about plays. We can talk, you know, all that sort of stuff as well.
Yeah, for sure.